White Sky, Black Ice, Chapter 1. Wednesday morning, Chukchi. Ordinarily, Alaska State Trooper Nathan Active didn't get involved with deaths inside the city limits. But the Chukchi city cops were all out and he was flirting with Lucy the dispatcher when the call came in, so he took it. "You better get over here, Nathan," said Hector Martinez. "Some kid shot himself across from the Dreamland, and I want him moved." "Who is it?" "Don't matter who," Martinez said. "You just come get him. He's scaring away business." The bar owner hung up. Active climbed the stairs to his office, took his fur hat and down parka from the hooks by the door, and went out to the 8-year-old's Trooper Suburban. The west wind that had set in yesterday scraped his face as he unlocked the driver's door and tossed in his briefcase. A thin gray belt of cloud scrolled overhead, spitting snow at the narrow tongue of beach gravel and tundra that contained Chukchi's square, unpainted wooden houses and its straggling dirt streets. He had arrived at work only an hour before, but already the Suburban's windshield was covered. The temperature was maybe 6 above, he judged as he brushed off the snow. The warm spell of the past few days was definitely over. There were many things he had come to detest about Chukchi since the troopers had posted him there 18 months before, but it was probably the west wind he detested most. It was the west wind's toothache-like persistence. God help you if you had to go gloveless in it, changing spark plugs on the Suburban or working on evidence camera. It gnawed at your hands and sprayed grit in your eyes. Inside a house at night you could hear it scratching bushes and weeds against the wall. You could feel it suck warm air out of the cracks around the windows and push cold air under the door and through the electric sockets. Well, he could persist, too. Another year or two and he could figure on being promoted out of Chukchi to Alaska State Trooper Headquarters in Anchorage, where his adoptive parents lived and where he had been raised and where, thank God, the west wind never blew like it did here in Chukchi, the village where he was born. Pulled out of the parking lot behind the Chukchi Public Safety Building, a 3-story stack of fading brown plywood and blue aluminum roofing. He drove up 3rd Street, the only paved road in town, turned right at Lake Street, then drove east a block and stopped across from the Dreamland. The Chukchi police van was already there, and two officers were walking toward something in a clump of willows, maybe 75 yards out onto the tundra. The dispatcher must have reached the city cops by radio, or caught one of them at home by phone. Several Honda four-wheelers were pulled up beside Lake Street, too. A gaggle of breakfast drinkers watched the proceedings from the steps of the Dreamland. They were probably the business scared away from Martinez's bar. Active followed the city cops to where the dead man lay on his back near the edge of the Chukchi Cemetery. He was young, his black hair was collar-length, and he wore a small mustache. His legs were drifted over with snow, but his head and upper body, more sheltered by the willows, were only lightly frosted. There was a snow-covered rifle across his snow-covered legs, a bullet-sized hole in his throat, and a shadowy stain on the snow under his neck. Active was sure that, when they turned him over, they would find a much larger hole where the slug had come out. "Mind if I take a look?" he asked one of the city cops, a white man named Mason. Mason nodded. "Just don't touch anything till the chief gets here." Active squatted and studied the rifle through its dusting of snow. It looked like an old 30-30 Winchester carbine, good for anything from seal to caribou, even moose. Most people nowadays had newer rifles that shot farther and hit harder, but 30-30s were still common in Chukchi, where nothing was thrown away if it still worked, or might do so again some day. Active stood up. There were some liquor bottles lying around, mostly plastic travelers that could be hauled in a boat, plane, or snow machine without breaking. But Martinez ran a package store next to the Dreamland, so the tundra nearby was always littered with bottles. How many of them had the boy with the hole in his throat emptied in his last hours? Active turned as footsteps crunched in the snow behind him. Jim Silver, the city police chief, stopped beside Active and studied the corpse. Silver was tall and paunchy with an acne-cratered face. He had been around Chukchi since before Active was born. Active imagined that Silver would still be there, like the west wind, when Active was long gone. "Another one, huh?" "Looks like it," Silver said. "Third suicide since the weather turned cold." You know him? I think so, but let me check. Silver squatted and patted the boy's coat pockets, then reached into one and pulled out a photo ID badge by a corner. Yep, he said after a moment's study. George Clinton, one of Daniel's boys. Looks like he got himself a job at the Grey Wolf Mine. He waved the badge at Active, then tucked it back into the same pocket it had come from. We'll move him pretty soon. We just need to get some pictures for the coroner. Not that there's much doubt what happened. Well, you don't need me. I'm only here because Lucy couldn't find you guys at first. Active started toward the Suburban. Actually, there is one thing. He turned, knowing what was coming. Silver was white and so were the other city cops on the scene. He, Nathan Active, was Inupiat Eskimo, like George Clinton. You got a minute to go by and break the news to old Daniel? Jim, I speak less Inupiat than you do. You know that. Well, Daniel's English is pretty good. How about one of the other guys? Active jerked a thumb toward the two city cops starting to work over George Clinton's body. Oh, I need them here for a while yet. Active shook his head and shrugged. Where's the house? Silver pointed across the tundra to the southeast, that white one there by the lagoon. You owe me, Jim. I owe you, Silver said. Active walked back to the Suburban and pulled out his keys. Going uptown? He turned. A scrawny civilian in a Mariner's baseball cap and in a long, dirty blue parka had detached himself from the gang around the Dreamland steps and was walking toward the Suburban, a can of Olympia in hand. Not uptown, Kinnock. I'm going down toward the airport, Active said. Great, me too, Kinnock Wilson said in his high voice. He climbed into the passenger seat of the Suburban, cradling the beer between his knees. Kinnock Wilson was a part-time marijuana dealer who did just enough business to keep himself in beer. The troopers and the city cops tolerated him for two reasons. One, anybody who could get people to smoke pot rather than guzzle booze was doing everybody a favor in the eyes of the Chukchi law enforcement establishment. And two, Kinnock Wilson liked to talk to cops. The weird thing was, everybody in town knew he talked, but instead of dropping him through a hole in the sea ice some night, the bootleggers and the rest of Chukchi's riffraff kept talking to Kinnock, and Kinnock kept passing it along. Active never could figure it out, but why look a gift horse in the mouth? He climbed into the driver's seat. You're going to see old Daniel about Georgia, Wilson said as Active turned the key. Yep, but you're not. No, I'll wait out in your truck. Active headed east on Lake Street toward the lagoon. They bounced along in silence for a good 10 seconds. Too bad about Georgia, Wilson said. Active said nothing. When Kinnock Wilson had something to say, silence was the best way to get him to say it. It was his turn, though. His turn? Active was immediately irritated with himself for breaking his vow of silence. Yeah, from the Clinton curse. The Clinton curse? You never hear about it? You mind if I turn up your heater? I'll a paw today. Wilson flipped the fan onto high without waiting for an answer. You didn't know two of Daniel's other boys killed themselves already? Oh, yeah, I forget you was down in Anchorage with your white parents. He tilted the Olympia and swallowed Adam's apple bobbing in the scrawny neck. Active reached over and thumped the Ole can. You know you can't be in here with that. It's empty anyway. Wilson rolled down the window and tossed it onto the tundra. What about this curse? Oh, yeah. Wilson rolled the window up again. It started maybe 15 years ago. There was this old man, Billy Carl, up on Beach Street. He used to make dog sleds. Active nodded, turning the Suburban onto 4th Street. Now they were headed south, parallel to the lagoon. It was freezing up as winter came on, the spot of open water in the middle, shrinking like the pupil of an eye in bright light. Billy Carl have this kid named Frank, Wilson said in the stripped-down village English that was starting to sound as familiar to Active as the standard English spoken in Anchorage. Another reason to get out of Chukchi as soon as possible. Frank decided he want Daniel Clinton's wife, even though she's a lot older than him, Wilson went on. She and Frank Carl were cousins or something. And you know them Carls, they always like to monkey around with their relatives. That's why they're so goofy. How do you know this? George told me about it when we're in 5th grade. Then I guess it must be true. Wilson ignored the sarcasm. Frank was no good, drinking and fighting all the time, and Annie, that's Daniel's wife, go to church a lot, so she won't have nothing to do with him. But Frank think it's because she want Daniel too much, and he start talking around town how Daniel better get out of the way. Finally one night, Frank get drunk and he go over to Daniel's house with a rifle. He's out front screaming and crying and shooting up in the air, threatening to come in and get Daniel and Annie and kill them both or shoot himself. This is before Daniel have a telephone, so there's not much him and Annie can do. They and their kids are trapped in there. They had reached Daniel Clinton's house now. Active stopped the Suburban in front, but he didn't get out. Wilson pointed at the weathered plywood storm shed attached to the front of Clinton's house. Frank go up to Daniel's cunnychuck there and start pounding on the door like hell. But Daniel put a board across it so Frank can't get in. Then Frank starts shooting through the door. Annie and all the kids get down behind some stuff in the back so he never hit anybody. Wilson looked from the cunnychuck to Active and back to the cunnychuck again. But Daniel have all he can take. He put a slug in his shotgun and he stick the muzzle right up against the cunnychuck door and he pull the trigger. Well, he make a lucky shot. That slug punch a big hole right through Frank's guts and hit his spine. Frank fall dead right there. There, Wilson pointed again at the storm shed. See them holes in the door of the cunnychuck? They say that's the holes Daniel and Frank make shooting at each other that night. The big one is from when Daniel finally killed Frank. Active studied the door. The hole looked too big and smooth-edged even for a shotgun slug. But perhaps it would look like that after 15 years of rain and wind and kids poking sticks through it. So what happened? Oh, them Nalakmi cops decided self-defense and they let it go, Wilson said. But the Eskimos know it's not over. For one thing, Frank was the only boy that Billy had. The rest of his kids was all girls. Besides that, you know what an angatkuk is? Active remembered the word from a book his adopted parents had given him to help him understand his origins. At the time, he had been more interested in Hardy Boy's mysteries. A shaman? Yeah, that's right, Wilson said. Early days ago, before the missionaries come, the angatkuks run everything. The old-time Eskimos thought they could do magic, and they were scared of them. Anyway, Billy Carl was supposed to be from a family of angatkuks, and a lot of people always think he's one himself. So everybody wait to see how he will kill Daniel Clinton. They think it will be a real old-time Eskimo blood feud. Active shifted to look at the holes in the cunnychuck door again, then turned back to Wilson. But Daniel's still alive. That's right. Billy never kill him. One night there's big blizzard and somebody knock on Daniel's door. When he open it, there's Billy. He look in and he see Annie back in there, and George and their four boys, and he stare at each boy in turn. "I won't take any revenge on you for what you did," he tell Daniel. "But you took my son from me, and now your sons will take themselves away from you." Wilson turned toward Active, then swung his gaze around the Suburban, like Billy Carl studying Daniel Clinton's cursed sons. Then he looked at Active again. About 50% of what Wilson said was true, usually. But it was braided with the untrue, like the strands of a rope. Wilson's tale of curses and blood feuds didn't sound like anything in any of the books Active's adoptive parents had given him, or in the anthropology courses he had taken while studying criminology at the University of Alaska. Did you see this with your own eyes?
No, but everybody say it, Wilson said. The oldest boy's about 16 at the time, and he was sort of friendly with Frank Carl. He hang himself a couple years later. Ever since then, them Clinton boys always kill themselves when they get to be about 20. So far, the curse get 'em all. After George, Daniel only have one boy left.
Billy Carl says a few words, and Daniel boys just start killing themselves, Active asked. Come on.
It makes sense if you don't think about it, Wilson said. If you plant the idea in some dumb Eskimo's mind he's going to kill himself, he probably will.
Don't say that, Kenneth, Active said. The Inupiat aren't dumb.
Then how come we kill ourselves so much?
Active knew the argument was pointless. Kinnick had absorbed the white man's contempt for the Inupiat, and it would take more than finger shaking from a state trooper to erase it. But he took one more swipe at it.
It's called culture shock.
I just call it dumb Eskimos, Wilson shrugged.
That's why Daniel and his boys believe what Billy Carl say. Your sons will take themselves away from you, Active repeated. Despair blew through Chukchi's streets like the west wind. He wondered if he could endure it long enough to get that transfer to Anchorage.
Maybe if the first one didn't do it, then the others would have a chance, Wilson said. But them younger boys, seeing their brothers kill theirself, they start to know it's going to happen to them. Them dumb Eskimos feel themselves get smaller and smaller. Pretty soon they're gone.
Sounds like you've been there yourself.
Sometimes I...
Wilson stopped talking and looked at Daniel Clinton's cunnychuck again. I just go to that dreamland and I get feeling good again. Don't touch anything, Active said, and climbed down from the Suburban. When he glanced back, Wilson was pulling a fresh ollie from a pocket of his parka. Active went through the cunnychuck and knocked on the inside door. He looked around while he waited, savoring the sharp, oily smells in the shed. Several parkas hung from nails on the walls, alongside some steel traps, a pair of caribou mukluks and the hides of a marten and two foxes. Two red plastic jugs for snow machine and boat gas sat on the floor in a corner. In another corner stood three rifles and two shotguns. Active walked over and inspected them. No 30-30 Winchester carbine. There was a noise behind the door, and an Indipat woman opened it. She was in her early 50s, Active guessed. Her eyes were red, and she clutched a soggy ball of Kleenex in one hand. "Are you Mrs. Clinton?" he asked. "We already hear about George," she said. "You don't need to come here." "Well, I just need to ask a few questions for my report." She led him into one end of a hallway that divided the house in half. At the opposite end was a partly drawn green curtain, and behind that, a bathtub and a toilet. "Daniel is in there," she pointed to a doorway off to the right, and Active went in. Daniel Clinton sat at a formica-top dining table with a cup of coffee in front of him. He had a round mahogany face above a squat, solid-looking body. A small black-and-white television on the table was tuned to the State Bush Channel, which was showing a Wheel of Fortune rerun. Clinton paid no attention to the coffee or the television. He was looking out across the lagoon to the white folds of tundra beyond. Unlike his wife, he was dry-eyed. There was one other person in the room. A thin boy with long black hair, maybe 15, lay on a couch reading an Archie comic. If Kenneth Wilson's story was right, this was Daniel Clinton's last son. The boy looked up and said, "Don't look at me," as if reading Active's mind. Daniel Clinton turned and saw Active. "You could go in the other room, Julius," he said. The teenager moved, but not to another room. Active heard the door out of the house slam, then the door of the cunnychuck. Clinton turned off the television. "Thank you for coming to see us, Mr. Active," Clinton said. "I'm sorry if we bother you." "I'm sorry for your trouble, Mr. Clinton." "It's my fault, from something that happened long time ago," Clinton said. "You was gone in Anchorage with your Nalakmi parents then." Active wasn't surprised to find out how much Daniel Clinton knew about him. Since his arrival the year before, word had spread rapidly that the Chukchi baby adopted by white schoolteachers had grown up and come back as an Alaska State Trooper. Those who hadn't known his history had quickly dipped it from the river of gossip that coursed constantly through the streets of the village. "I think I might have heard something about that," Active said, to let Clinton know he didn't need to talk about the curse, if he didn't want to. "Will you like some coffee, Mr. Active?" Clinton said. Obviously, Clinton didn't want to talk about it. Active nodded, and when Clinton had poured him a cup, asked if George had acted different lately. "No, he seemed fine to me. He get a job at that Gray Wolf, and he have some money. Buy a new snow-go. He seem happy. He say he move out and get his own place pretty soon," Clinton said. "I start to think maybe George will be the one to make it. But I guess not." The Gray Wolf was a huge copper mine that had opened a few months earlier, 100 miles north of Chukchi, on Gray Wolf Creek. A Norwegian mining company named Geonord ran the mine, but it was on land owned by Chukchi Region Incorporated, the native corporation that all the Inupiat in the area belonged to. So the Norwegians hired a lot of Inupiat, and the work schedule was tailored to people who liked to hunt and fish. 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, with the company paying for the plane rides back and forth to the Grey Wolf, or giving the equivalent in cash to those who preferred to ride their snow machines. He just came back from the Grey Wolf? Monday, I think. He hang out with his buddies, go down to that Geonord office for something about his job, go rabbit hunting behind the lagoon, stay over at Emily Hoffman's, just run around. You know how it is with them young guys. I think he was going caribou hunting, if that ice on Chukchi Bay ever get good again, from this warm spell we had. Emily Hoffman? Active wrote the name in his notebook. His girlfriend, Clinton said. She's pregnant, I guess. I was thinking maybe she'll be his wife pretty soon. Do you know who we went to see at Geonord? He never tell me, Clinton said. He'd just say you have to straighten something out. When he come back, he'd just say everything is fine. They found a 30-30 rifle with him. Did he have one? I keep one in my cunny chuck, Clinton said. I could check if it's there. No, I looked on the way in, Active said. It's not. He take that old 30-30? Clinton said desolately in his husky, sibilant voice. I teach him to shoot with that gun. He looked out over the lagoon again. I remember the first time I take him out on the ice for seal. Spring day, sunny, blue sky, not much wind. We go out on Snowgo, maybe 15-20 miles where there's lots of air holes. I find pressure ridge by air hole that look like it get used a lot, and I put George up there to wait. He's just a little guy, maybe 8 or 9, but he lay there in his white parkie real quiet for a long time watching that air hole. Finally, that seal put his head through, and I think maybe George will shoot too soon, and that seal will fall back through the hole. Maybe we lose it. But George don't shoot. He wait. Pretty soon, that seal haul out on the ice and take one more look around before he go to sleep, and that's when George shoot him. George hit him right in the eye, and he don't even flop around. He just drop his head down like he's going to sleep. George, he look at me, and he say, I'm a real Eskimo now, huh, Pop? Clinton stopped talking and picked at the edges of a triangular chip in the formica. Someone had outlined the hole with a red crayon. I never think he used that old Winchester for this. Clinton stopped talking again, and Active saw that now there were tears on his cheeks. Active closed his notebook and left. And that's chapter one of White Sky, Black Ice. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, try sending me an email to sj.alaska@gmail.com and tell me how you felt about it. If it goes over well, perhaps I'll do some more. If you're interested in buying a copy of White Sky, Black Ice, you can order it from amazon.com. Thanks, and goodbye from Stan Jones in Anchorage.